Earlier this year at Bagram Air Base, Afghanistan, a thank you note from Vice President Cheney.
We know the work is hard. We know the conditions are tough. We know the deployments are hard on families. But we're impressed beyond measure by all of the accomplishments.
Measuring what accomplishments? Troop count rising along with the death count, Afghan government weakening, Taliban strengthening. Will the next administration thank Bush and Cheney for all that remains to be done in Afghanistan? Khyber pass-fail pop quiz in the war on terror. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, October 7th. And John, you remind me, we actually haven't seen Vice President Dick Cheney for a while in a public appearance.
Undisclosed location. Maybe we can disclose it. Good morning, Adora. What else we got going?
We got a lot. We look at the economic woes in the U.S. and also the economic woes globally. Tonight, the second presidential debate gives undecided voters a chance to ask the candidates questions. We have a preview from Nashville. Baseball fever and a report on the U.S. policy in the Afghanistan war. But first, these headlines.
Shaky markets after yesterday's historic volatility. European stocks are flat this morning following much of Asia's lead. 1% interest rate cut in Australia helped spur recoveries there, but Japan's Nikkei was the exception, closed down more than 3%. The Dow futures are poised for a bounce back this morning. President Bush urging patience as the Fed gets down to the work of buying up bad debt that's at the heart of this credit crisis.
It's going to take a while to restore confidence in the financial system. But one thing people can be certain of is that the bill I signed is a big step toward solving this problem.
Now that the White House's financial plan has passed, Congress is looking into how things got so bad. Lehman Brothers CEO Richard Fuld was up yesterday testifying. He said he miscalculated the depth of the mortgage crisis.
I thought it was contained. We thought it was contained. And experts thought it was contained.
Today, three AIG executives will testify, and a House panel will take a closer look at how the crisis is hitting individual investors' retirement accounts.
More intervention in the economy. The Federal Reserve is working with the Treasury Department on a plan to buy commercial paper now, a short-term day-to-day business financing mechanism. The market for the paper, which relies on investors rather than banks, has virtually dried up.
Two Japanese citizens and an American will share the 2008 Nobel Prize in Physics. Their research involved the discovery of a mechanism called spontaneous broken symmetry in subatomic physics.
No symmetry in baseball. The Red Sox beat Los Angeles 3-2 last night, lopsided. That means they'll advance to face Tampa Bay on Friday. The Rays trounced the White Sox 6-2 last night to win their first ever playoff series. The National League, the Dodgers face the Phillies on Thursday. McCain and Obama hold their second debate tonight at Nashville's Belmont University. We'll be live blogging. Please join us at thetakeaway.org. Oil's around $90 a barrel. The S&P poised to open in positive territory this morning, and we're talking about fairness.
Yeah, what does that mean to you in a dispute, let's say, with your children? How do you decide what's fair? Give us your thoughts on the bailout plan. Is it fair? 877-8-MY-TAKE or drop us a note at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. It looks like a bounce back on Wall Street this morning, but in general, around the world, markets are floating around this morning. The Nikkei average in Japan closed down an additional 3%, close to a five-year low. The real test this morning, though, seems to be in Europe, where finance ministers are meeting, and the question is, can they support the euro? Can they support their banking system? latest figures are that they can currency and financial instability has gone as far as Iceland. The Iceland Central Bank has taken extraordinary steps to restrict its exchange rate. More banks are failing in Europe, more exchange rates being adjusted. Peter Morici joins us now. He's a professor at the University of Maryland School of Business and a former chief economist at the U.S. International Trade Commission. Peter, thanks for joining us.
Nice to be with you.
You know, there's always like 5,000 things to ask you and never enough time, but I might as well begin right at the top. I gather you were brokenhearted. You must have been weeping watching a Richard Fuld of Lehman Brothers there in front of Waxman's committee in Congress. I imagine it was a deep personal angst for you.
Oh, yes, it was.
Yeah, yeah. So what does it mean for a corporate CEO of the stature of Richard Fuld to get his pay examined by Congress?
Well, I think if you're going to take the kind of money the folks at Lehman take, which was nearly half of the profits of the company they put in the pockets of the executives, somebody's going to start asking questions, because that's about all we can do. It's an employment contract. The fact of the matter is it's been established by the courts that companies can pay executives whatever they like, as long as it's approved by the duly elected board.
Well, we're going to talk more about the Fuld situation in Congress later. What I want to do is focus on the markets here. You know, the question really is, what is the price of the assets that the Fed is going to buy? And there are discussions this morning, apparently, between the Federal Reserve and the Treasury Department to actually get into the commercial paper market as well. I mean, does this agreement, now that they're working out the details, open up the candy store for Secretary Paulson to buy up anything?
Well, it pretty well, he can buy just about whatever he likes under that thing. The problem is, how do you do it? Essentially, to have a reverse auction, you have to have like securities. Banks have to be bidding with like securities. You know, you say, today I'm going to buy $25 million worth of BAA mortgage-backed bonds. Well, what happens is the holders bid by bidding discount. You know, one guy says, I'll sell you mine for 75 cents on a dollar. Another guy says, well, I'll sell mine for 73. And on down it goes. Now, the real catch here is making sure they're all alike. And that is that you have to be able to have this auction in the same category. So you're buying, like a tobacco auction, you're buying the same grade of tobacco. One of the problems we had was the bond rating agencies did a terrible job of categorizing these bonds. And that's how investors, not so much the banks, investors got snookered.
So we're really starting from ground zero. I mean, trying to figure out what these things even are, let alone what they're worth.
Well, we know something about what they are, but we have to be precise, right? Because what will happen is that if you have a broad class of assets as opposed to, you know, exact same or very narrow, then you're just going to end up getting low bids, you know, on the worst paper. The banks will unload their worst paper, and to some degree the Treasury will get schnookered and they will get subsidized.
Well, two things then. Is the market's fall yesterday somehow an indication that they don't have a whole lot of confidence in the process that you're describing there, or is it something deeper?
No, I don't think most people have an appreciation for what I was just discussing. I think they feel there'll be an auction and the paper will be bought and the banks will get their money, and that's what they're worried about. I think they figure the banks are already getting a free ride. They don't care whether they get a little extra subsidy. But yesterday happened because of two things. One is Europe had its countrywide last weekend in the form of Hippo Real Estate in Germany. Remember, Germany's the third largest economy in the world after the United States and Japan. And they had a major banking crisis with the failure of Hippo, which is kind of an analog to Countrywide. It's a real estate bank or a real estate investment trust of sorts. Remember, they're organized differently than we are.
Right.
And they had to guarantee the deposits in their banks, which followed Ireland doing it the previous week. And now yesterday there was a great deal of intervention by the European central banks because there's a falling confidence in the banks there. The fact is the banks are in trouble there as well because they've all been using the same lousy management model. It's just that Wall Street seems to have abused it even more than others.
You know, this fellow...
Mr. Fuld is an example of that abuse.
Right. No, I understand that. And you've made that point many times, and I think we're going to explore it a little more later on in the hour. But Bill Gross, the CEO of PIMCO, which is a big investment house that deals with bonds and all kinds of obscure investments, has offered free of charge to set up some kind of a market for these toxic assets. Do you think it's possible to create a trading market for this stuff so that the federal government isn't just buying either the worst price or getting taken advantage of in the way that you described earlier?
It's not either or. By the federal government becoming involved in this process, it actually creates a market because multiple banks will be bidding to get rid of paper, and that will establish among themselves what they think that your stuff is really worth. Remember, we have limited information on this paper, but the people who have the best limited information are the banks themselves. Or they're in the position to explore best, which you basically have to explore the mortgages that are behind the paper and ask, what is the default rate, and what is the likely price at which I can sell defaulted properties? Because that determines how much the paper will be discounted. Any mortgage that pays out, you know, it does not require a discount. It's those that don't.
Right. Finally, last question. Why does it seem like in Europe they're more likely to have a run on the bank and panic as depositors than it seems to be the case here in the United States? That's what we saw over the weekend.
Well, our deposit insurance situation is probably the best in the world, and we really have convinced people that they will get their money. I can't say I've studied this statistically, but we've probably had more bank failures here because of the nature of our banking system. It's highly fragmented. We don't really have that many national banks. So we have little banks fail, and people get their money, and they see the system works. Also in Europe, you have to remember that once the Irish guaranteed deposits with electronic transfer and everybody using the euro but the Brits, the money moves real easy.
Oh, so the fact that
people pull out of it, they pull their money out of an Italian bank and put it in an Irish bank.
Interesting.
With a phone call.
That's really interesting.
The way you do New York to Pennsylvania, they can do that Italy or Germany to Ireland.
Wow.
It's just a phone call.
Of course.
All you need to be able to do is give them the routing number. So the question is, do you have to send them a check to give them the routing number, or will they take it over the wire?
So things go really, really quickly over there. We're going to be exploring how much of a test this is for the whole Eurozone economic model. Peter Morici, thank you very much for joining us.
We'll see you again.
Peter Morici is, of course, professor at the University of Maryland School of Business and former chief economist at the U.S. International Trade Commission. Dora?
That was a really interesting point.
Yeah,
really
well,
interesting.
We're
going
to see more of that money whipping around in Europe, I have a feeling, over the next week or so.
And all of these economic woes, both globally and what's happening here in the United States, are really having a serious effect on the presidential election. There's a new poll today from the Wall Street Journal and NBC News, which is indicating that more people approve of Barack Obama's handling and plan for the economy than that of John McCain. Tonight, the candidates meet for their second debate. And for more, we're turning now to our political director, Andrea Bernstein. Good morning, Andrea.
Good morning.
So the economy, clearly a critical issue for Americans, and Barack Obama seems to be doing a little better than John McCain. That surprise you?
Well, it doesn't surprise me, since it's an issue in which the Democrats or in which voters have given the Democrats the edge for the entire campaign. And historically, Democrats tend to get the edge on the economy. What is surprising is how rapid there's been a shift. I'm now in Indiana, and we're going to be talking a little bit more about that in a minute. But what is astounding to me is the extent to which, in the 4 weeks that I have thus far been going to counties that count, that the voters have swayed so strongly to Obama, and they have a logic that's attached to it, which has to do with how they feel about his handling of the economy.
And how important do you think this poll, as well as the last couple of polls in the last couple of days, all sort of swinging towards Barack, how important is that on this day when the presidential candidates are going to be meeting once again?
Well, I think that, I mean, one of the things that really surprised me yesterday is I met so many voters who were not undecided, who had made up their minds. Many of them said they'd made up their minds Friday after the vice presidential debate.
Oh, that's interesting.
So I'm certain there are more undecided voters out there. There's still a great yearning for a plan. And if, as expected, McCain keeps up the attacks that Sarah Palin has been making on Barack Obama, that's a tough row for him to hoe, because voters really want to know the details of his economic plan. They want to know how he's going to get us out of this mess. And pretty much everybody that I spoke to, from the firmest Obama supporters to the firmest McCain supporters, were unmoved to unhappy with the personal attacks on both sides.
Andrea, I'm going to ask you to hang on. We're going to have a quick check of the news. Andrea Bernstein, the Takeaway political director. She is in Vandenberg County, Indiana, with a report coming up on the counties that count.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
And, of course, Obama, you know, he's got black in him, so, you know, I'm black and proud. So I have to. He may not get in.
We really don't know what all Obama stands for. He just, you know, just doesn't have a record yet.
Those are two Indiana voters. Early voting is open there, so they have the opportunity to cast their ballot. We're going to continue right now with Takeaway Political Director Andrea Bernstein, who is in Vandenberg County. Now, this is the latest county in our Counties That Count series, and a new poll out this morning by Wish TV in Indianapolis shows a dead heat between Barack Obama and John McCain. Interesting turn, because 2000 and 2004, the state went decidedly for President Bush. Good morning, Andrea. Where are you exactly?
Good morning. I'm in JoJo's restaurant in Evansville, staring right at the coconut cream pie in the pie case.
And what have voters been telling you in the last 2 days that you've been in Indiana?
Well, I'm in Evansville, which is in the southwestern corner, kind of in the tail of Indiana, wedged between southern Illinois and Kentucky. And what is fascinating is very few undecideds. People have been making up their minds. Quite a few said they made them up in the last 2 weeks after the vice presidential debate. There are still a lot of working people here in Evansville, Indiana, a lot of plants. There's a Toyota plant. There's a couple of ethanol plants. And one of the voters I spoke to over in the Civic Center, which is, by the way, at the corner of Martin Luther King Boulevard and Main Street, cannot make these things up. The first voter that I spoke to looked like what Sarah Palin has called Joe Sixpack, you know, a big union guy, a pipe fitter, and that would, you would think, be John McCain's demographic, but when I asked him who he was voting for, he had something else to say.
I would have voted for John McCain probably in 2000, but not now. It's just he's a little bit outdated for, you know, what I think's going on right now.
And clearly the economy is on everyone's mind, Andrea, but were there some particular concerns in Indiana that you found really played or playing a part in people's minds?
Well, the economy is just blowing out everything, although a lot of these union members were talking about health care. Clearly, there's been a big education campaign inside the unions, and a lot of the union members I spoke to, very high proportion of the voters I ran into, said they were voting on health care. They said they didn't like John McCain's health care plan. There was also a factor about last week's vice presidential debate. Seems that Sarah Palin actually turned some people off, like Sharon, a retired teacher.
I think it's an insult to me as a woman that John McCain would think that she's qualified to run this country. I'm real offended by her little cutesy winking and you betcha stuff. I think she's a joke.
Now, was this a woman who had previously voted Republican?
Yes, she had. And I found a lot of people who had previously voted Republican saying they were now voting Democrat. After the polls closed, I went over to the Westside Nut Festival, which is the big fall festival here in Indiana. And I do want to say I did run into Republicans like this gentleman who was supporting McCain in part because he did like Sarah Palin.
Right, because she's just a down-to-earth person. You know, they're picking on her because she's got an unusual family and everything. We need to get onto what she's done and not what, you know.
It must have been interesting, Andrea. You've been covering politics all year, and finally you could talk to someone who would actually cast a ballot in this presidential election.
Right. It is a little bit head-turning that you can do that now. But I'll tell you what was even more head-turning, and I went and checked. Did Vandenberg County actually go 60-40 Bush-Kerry? Because I ran into so many people who said they were voting Democrat, like this man. He's a retired military man. He's been in the military all his life. His name is Robert Robb. He says he voted for Bush twice, but said he's voting for Obama.
I know he doesn't have the experience, but I don't like McCain because of what McCain's done as a senator. So, you know.
What is it that he's done as a senator that you don't like?
Well, he's started with oil companies, and he took some lobbyist money. And when they start doing that, you might as well just let them go because, as far as I'm concerned, they've been bought off.
Do you usually vote Democrat, Republican?
I don't vote Democrat or Republican. I just vote for who I like.
So when McCain says, I'm the guy that's going to keep you safe.
I don't believe that.
Andrea, I don't know if you're just attracted to wonky people or what, but it seems like the issues have cast these people out of their traditional categories of Republican and Democrat.
You know, people are really hurting, and I think that, you know, I asked a lot of people about all this stuff floating around, the charges and countercharges. Pretty much when people are worried about losing their jobs, they're worried about their retirement, what they want to hear are the issues. And that is what everybody told me about tonight's debate. Jason and Teresa Coltis were the only truly, really undecided voters I found here in Vandenberg County. And they said tonight they want details.
Show me how my children's education, the ratios to teachers to students are going to become better. Show me how there's not going to be 30 kids in my daughter's first grade class and she can get more individual attention. Those are the things I'm going to listen to. Tell us we're not going to have to pay $3,000 in health care expenses this year. That would be nice to hear.
Could you see yourself voting for Senator McCain?
I'm right down the middle. I'm afraid in November I'm going to choose the lesser of two evils. That's how I look at it.
So could you see yourself going either way? I mean, could
yes.
you see yourself voting for Senator Obama?
Yeah, I could vote for either one right now.
As we get closer to Election Day, voters wanting details like this couple that you just talked to makes you wonder whether or not tonight in this town hall forum that we're going to see the presidential candidates, whether some of those questions won't be asked.
It's a trap for Senator McCain because on the one hand, where he is now in the polls, like the poll here in Indiana, he has to make people start doubting Senator Obama. He has to pull those voters away from Obama. But at the same time, if he doesn't say positively what he wants to do, voters like the Coltises are going to hold it against him.
So it's going to be... So that's, I mean, that's between a rock and a hard place or not, really, if you have a plan.
People say they want to hear a plan, they want to hear details, but with the way the polls are going, and, you know, I was back here in Indiana, we were chatting over just before the Republican convention, and it was a very undecided to leaning red state. It seems very much different now.
Andrea Bernstein, thank you.
Thank you.
It's Andrea Bernstein, the Takeaway's political director, with another report on our series of counties that count.
Well, you heard that list from the Coltises wanting to hear if people will have to pay $3,000 in health care expenses this year. Would you vote for Senator McCain? Are you looking for educational reform? What issues are you looking for in this debate? We want to know at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. You've certainly asked, you know, you've certainly shared what you're looking for in the debate last week with the vice presidential candidates.
Yeah, if you could ask a question, if you could ask one of the 15 questions that will be presented to the two candidates, what would that be? 877-8-MY-TAKE, we'd like to hear it.
No boxes or briefs, please.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering auto insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
time for headlines now from Richard Hake, who's sitting in for Femi Okay. Good morning, Richard.
Good morning, Adora. It's 28 minutes before the top of the hour right now. The Federal Reserve is providing more details about when it will make billions of dollars in short-term loans available to squeezed banks. The loans will be made available through auctions conducted through the rest of the year. Some $900 billion in cash loans will be made for 28 or 84 days. Australia's central bank lifted Asian markets this morning by cutting rates by the largest amount since 1992. Wall Street is headed for a slightly higher open today amid hopes the central banks around the world will follow suit. It's 7 years to the day since the U.S. led an invasion of Afghanistan. Retired General Jack Keane is considered to be the architect of the Iraq surge. He believes a similar approach should be employed in Afghanistan.
We really must accelerate the development of the Afghan National Army. I mean, we doubled the size of the Iraqi military, and we produced 100,000 troops in 1 year. And it made a tangible and decisive difference in 2007 when that took place.
Meanwhile, Defense Secretary Robert Gates is endorsing efforts to reach out to members of the Taliban in Afghanistan who may be considered reconcilable. He also rejected assertions made by the top British commander there that the war is not winnable. And we just learned from the Associated Press that a Kenyan airport official says the American author of a book attacking Barack Obama is being deported. Jerome Corsi, who wrote The Obama Nation, Leftist Politics, and the Cult of Personality, was picked up at his hotel in Nairobi, apparently because he didn't have a work visa. Immigration officials say he failed to get that while he was trying to launch his book.
And, of course, his book is very critical of Barack Obama. Barack Obama is very popular in Kenya because his dad is Kenyan.
Was an economist in Kenya.
Interesting. Yeah. Thank you, Richard.
You're welcome.
And we are talking about the debate between John McCain and Barack Obama. We were going to ask you, if you were in the audience tonight, what question would you be asking to the candidates? Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can drop us a note at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Today on Capitol Hill, Congress will be holding more hearings on the financial crisis, and particularly the role of the troubles of AIG, one company, and the troubles of Lehman Brothers. We heard from CEO Dick Fuld yesterday, where you had Democratic California Representative Henry Waxman leading the House Oversight and Governmental Reform Committee and asking tough questions.
Seems that the system worked for you, but it didn't seem to work for the rest of the country and the taxpayers who now have to pay up to $700 billion to bail out our economy. We can't continue to have a system where Wall Street executives privatize all the gains and then socialize the losses. Accountability needs to be a two-way street.
On the line now with us is Todd Zwillick of Capital News Connection. Todd, you had one of the former titans of Wall Street being grilled yesterday over hundreds of millions of dollars he's made over the year. An extraordinary scene.
Exactly right. And the theme of revenge versus fairness was just rife in the room. It was sort of a combination of both of those things, a little bit of twinges of revenge as members, mostly Democrats, mind you, almost exclusively Democrats, went after Fuld for his, not only for his exorbitant compensation. There was some debate as to how much he took home, by the way. Maybe we can talk about that. But, going after Fuld for how much he took home while Rome burned there at Lehman Brothers. And then also fairness. Is it fair for these executives at this firm and at other firms? And there are more hearings today to have taken home what they took home while allegedly not paying attention to the fact that they were vulnerable to all this bad debt and bad credit and putting the rest of the country at risk at the same time.
So, Todd, was this really just political theater, or was there some substantive issues that brought some light to what happened to Lehman Brothers?
Well, like all good theater, it was a mixture of both. It is 4 weeks before an election. There's no way around that fact, and there's no way around the fact that the economic situation is a benefit to Democrats. And there's no way around the fact that placing blame early and often at the feet of others is an important part of politics. So here it is, the recess, and members are supposed to be home campaigning, but they've got Dick Fuld before the committee and before the TV cameras answering for somewhere between 350 and $500 million in personal compensation between 2000 and when Lehman failed.
He came across a little defiant. Would that be the right word? Let's listen to a bit of what he said yesterday.
What happened to Lehman Brothers could have happened to any financial institution and almost did happen to others. Bear Stearns, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, AIG, Washington Mutual, and Merrill Lynch all were trapped in this vicious cycle.
How would you sum up his presentation?
A combination of defiance, taking responsibility, and then also shifting responsibility. He did make a very definitive statement that the buck stops with him and he takes all responsibility for what went wrong at Lehman, and then came up with a litany of reasons as to why it was beyond his control. Of course, members, Democrats mostly, latched on to those latter statements, and some Republicans too, that he really didn't take responsibility for what went on and was asleep at the switch or was so jaded by conflicts of interest, his own compensation, and the fact that he was taken care of by an executive compensation board, that he didn't really have much cause to pay much attention to what was going on with the rest of the company and the rest of the market and how it affected everybody else.
Let's talk about that compensation, and let's first listen to an exchange between Fold and Henry Waxman.
When the company did well, we did well. When the company did not do well, sir, we did not do well.
Well, Mr. Fold, there seems to be a breakdown, because you did very well when the company was doing well, and you did very well when the company wasn't doing well, and now your shareholders who owned your company have nothing. They've been wiped out.
I mean, that was really an extraordinary sight to get a scolding. Here was a man who was running things, you know, not too long ago, getting a scolding for decisions they made.
Never underestimate the power of a party running for re-election. That might be a little bit simplistic, but this is such a big deal. It's a lot of this story isn't written yet. Members of Congress know how to take advantage of a situation at the right time. You know, you can make a good argument that it's necessary for a guy like Fold to be raked over the coals in front of the public.
Mm-hmm.
That's part of the process. It doesn't hurt one bit for Democrats especially, and for some other members, that this takes place right before an election. Don't forget, a lot of them took a very tough vote. Nobody liked voting for that bailout, and voters don't like it.
But they're certainly changing the script this week, or at least the tone of the conversation. Todd Zwillick, thanks so much for joining us this morning.
My pleasure.
Todd Zwillick coming to us from Capital News Connection in Washington, D.C. Those congressional hearings today on the failure of insurance giant AIG are this morning at 10 a.m.
Lehman Brothers yesterday, AIG on tap for today.
It's amazing
how the jousting continues.
Yeah, isn't it amazing how quickly these hearings were set up?
Yeah, well, part of it is posturing for the election, that's for sure.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning, I'm Adora Udoji, and this is The Takeaway.
And I'm John Hockenberry, and you know, it was just another boring October night at Fenway last night.
As Kotze Rob, now Lowry. He bounces one right side, throws it. Here comes Bayer out third. Willits loads up, throw the plate. Red Sox win it.
And the Red Sox advance, defeating the Los Angeles Angels 3-2 on a run-scoring single with two outs in the bottom of the ninth inning in Boston. The Tampa Bay Rays also won 6-2 over the White Sox in Chicago. And to talk about the American League advance and all other things, baseball sports writer Maggie Haskins joins us here in the studio. Maggie, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
Yeah, that is so great. I mean, the Red Sox were so depressed thinking that, you know, we've tempted fate being in the playoffs yet again, and yet they advance.
Yeah, I think it's the entire Red Sox mentality somewhat changed over the past few years. For one thing, this is the third time every year the Red Sox have gone to the ALCS. They've managed to work out a walk-off against the Angels in the first round.
Right,
so
exactly.
They're setting quite a standard. I think it's going to be an interesting matchup because here they are against the Tampa Bay Rays, and everybody's still waiting for the Rays to stop playing good baseball.
Although they hiccuped here in this series. I mean, it looked like they had some nerves going for them, but they really got things under control last night. And I guess the question is the Red Sox pitching strong enough without Dice K and maybe some of the other people in the bullpen to go up against the Rays?
I think so, if only because of the experience factor. Granted, this has been held against the Rays all season. They don't have the experience. But, you know, they've gone toe-to-toe with the Yankees and the Red Sox this season. They've actually won 10 out of the 18 games against the Red Sox. So Josh Beckett being hurt is going to probably be difficult for Game 4, but I don't think you can take anything away from the heart of that Red Sox lineup. Dustin Pedroia finally broke out of his slump. You always have David Ortiz there.
Right.
And I think they can overcome Mike Lowell's injury as well.
What about Longoria's slump on the Rays' side?
I think with a new series starting at home, you have to give a guy the benefit of the doubt that he can come out of it because, you know, first playoff series for the Tampa Bay Rays. Yeah. You got to expect a couple guys to have slumps.
So, Mags, I'm a little worried about your voice. Were you up screaming last night?
I was. There was a little bit of screaming.
Yeah,
right.
Okay. We don't want to betray any sort of affiliation here. Quickly on the National League, so the Cubs are out, but Phillies and Dodgers.
Yeah, I'm a Cubs fan, born and raised in Chicago.
Oh, how unfortunate for you. Yeah, there is no cure.
No, I'm still dealing with the anger part of the stages.
Well, the rest of the baseball universe would like you to talk about the teams that actually are going to be playing in October. Could you do that for us?
Okay, sure.
Yeah.
Phillies-Dodgers, intriguing matchup. Joe Torre. Yankees can't make the postseason for the 13th straight year, but he certainly can.
Joe Torre is going to make New York love the Dodgers. That's my prediction, whatever happens in this series.
Well, it's kind of funny because Yankees fans, Joe Torre, Manny Ramirez, did they ever think they would be, you know, pushing for them on the same team?
And Manny Ramirez could face the Red Sox in the series, depending on if they advance.
Well, and that's kind of Manny's dream. He loves being the center of attention, and there would be nothing greater, I think, for him than to have the entire World Series focused on him.
The only thing that would be greater would be have the entire series focused on you, Maggie.
Oh, well, of course.
Of course.
Maggie Huskins, and the Cubs.
Our center of attention here on the Takeaway Sports Writer, talking about the baseball series. The four teams are set. The pennant races are done. And next stop, the World Series. Maggie, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. If you could ask a question at tonight's presidential debate, what would you ask?
I wanted to ask Barack and John, why do you want this job at this time? What a mess.
What a mess. Let's see. What would you ask if you were there tonight in Nashville? 877-8-MY-TAKE or drop us a note at mytake@thetakeaway.org. We'd love to hear what you're thinking.
Yes, and first headlines from Richard Haig.
And, John, right now it is 12 minutes before the top of the hour. The Federal Reserve is considering a plan to buy short-term funds called commercial paper. That's what businesses use to fund their day-to-day operations. It also plans to loan about $900 billion to banks through an auction process. European finance ministers are meeting in Luxembourg to try to bolster that continent's financial system after yesterday's near panic. The House Oversight and Government Reform Committee is taking a deeper interest into the financial crisis. One hearing will look at the impact the market slump has had on personal retirement accounts. And another, three former AIG executives will testify about that company's bailout. Forecasters say Tropical Storm Marco could hit Mexico with near hurricane strength winds later in the day. The National Hurricane Center says it's a very small storm with winds extending only 10 miles out from its center, this on the Gulf side of Mexico. Still, officials have had to evacuate several oil platforms in the Gulf. And finally, the Nobel Prize in Physics was awarded today. Are you guys ready for the announcement?
I'm ready.
It's physics, mind you. So
physics.
See if you can understand this.
with one half to Professor Yoshide Nambu for the discovery of the mechanism of spontaneous broken symmetry in subatomic physics. The other half of the prize is awarded jointly to Professor Makoto Kobayashi and Professor Toshide Maskawa for the discovery of the origin of the broken symmetry, which predicts the existence of at least three families of quarks.
I totally got all of that, Richard.
You don't know what quarks are?
What's a quark?
And you're a newscaster?
I don't know what a quark
is. Oh, for heaven's sakes, Richard. Thank you very much.
John, you got to explain now.
Quarkless in New York. That's me. Well, moving to a very different subject. 7 years ago today, President Bush announced the beginning of the war in Afghanistan, and he ended his speech on this day 7 years ago with this promise.
The battle is now joined on many fronts. We will not waver. We will not tire. We will not falter, and we will not fail. Peace and freedom will prevail. Thank you. May God continue to bless America.
Today, more than 40 militants killed in continued fighting in Afghanistan. And to assess the rate of faltering and failure, if there is any in Afghanistan, we've got with us Anthony Cordesman, Dr. Anthony Cordesman for the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Anthony, thanks so much for joining us.
A pleasure.
You know, the Afghan situation started out so promising and yet then remained in a kind of a stasis for many, many years and now seems to be deteriorating precipitously, with even British commanders saying it's unwinnable. What, first of all, is the strategic flaw, if any, here?
Well, there are quite a number. I think one thing that we need to remember is that it took us something like 3 years after 2003 to get to nation building, to deal with the kind of strategy that General Petraeus introduced into Iraq. We never made that conversion inside Afghanistan. We basically were opposed to nation building, to creating a major force presence. We didn't try to create a large, effective Afghan army. We largely ignored Pakistan, putting more trust in Musharraf than we should. So what you see is not something sudden. Really, in 2005, we had seen the Taliban increase its area of influence inside Afghanistan by about 50%, according to now declassified U.S. intelligence maps. It doubled its area of influence between 2005 and 2006, and during that time, it steadily increased its area of influence inside both the tribal areas of Pakistan and Baluchistan, and no one really reacted. The aid money didn't come, the people didn't come, the troop increases really didn't come until this year, and those increases have fallen far short of the kind of increases that we needed inside Iraq.
Well, all those trends that you identify there are well known in the command structure in the U.S. military. And as he was taking over Central Command, General Petraeus, as he was leaving Iraq, talked to the BBC and had some pretty disturbing words about Afghanistan. Let's take a listen.
Afghanistan has emerged as very, very difficult this year. It was more difficult last year than the previous year and so forth. And so the trends are, again, are in the wrong direction. That has to be addressed.
It seems once again the U.S. military has engaged a strategy of incremental mission that accomplishes very, very little and then runs the risk of being overwhelmed as the trends reverse. How does Petraeus and the next administration deal with this?
Well, it's a very good question because basically we're fighting now. And an awful lot of the discussion in Washington is about measures that might have a benefit in 2 to 3 years. What General McKiernan has asked for, and I think we need to be careful about the U.S. military. When General Eikenberry was commander, when General McNeil was commander, when Ambassador Newman was ambassador to Afghanistan, they all asked for more resources, the kind of effort that could have taken the initiative and denied the Taliban and its affiliates the ability to expand. But the Bush administration, frankly, did not react for 4 years.
Well, in fact,
it didn't react largely because it simply didn't have the resources because of Iraq.
Well, but in fact, Donald Rumsfeld, 4 years, took credit for success in Afghanistan. But as you say, in fact, that success was illusory because all the time the seeds for this disaster were taking place. How do you think that strategic sort of position on the part of Rumsfeld has affected morale in the military in Afghanistan when so many years, so many requests for troops have been denied?
I think, quite frankly, at this point, it hasn't affected morale. You have a high sense of mission, and frankly, Secretary Rumsfeld was so unpopular with the U.S. military almost from the start that his impact on morale was relatively limited. This is a professional military that tried to do its job. But the question you asked about where we're going is really critical. General McKiernan has asked for 2 to 3 brigades. That's not because that's all he needs. The studies that have been done indicate that he needs about 5 at a minimum. One of the things that's totally missing are the number of civilian aid personnel. We don't have the advisors, either from our allies or ourselves, to help build up the Afghan army or police force. Before we planned to nearly double the Afghan army, we were really at about 30 to 40% of the advisory staffs. Now you've doubled the force goal. Of course, the number of advisors falls far short.
Well, Dr. Cordesman, I'm doing some arithmetic on the back of a napkin here. I mean, by that calculation, it seems to me to even get started, we're looking at close to 100,000 troops.
You're looking not at 100,000 troops, but 5 brigades would take you into the 30,000 to 40,000 at a minimum.
But adding the advisors and the civilian personnel and the NATO troops?
That would be, we're not talking about more NATO troops because you're not going to get significantly more. The advisory staffs are so small that rather than talking about tens of thousands, at this point you're talking about thousands, and the fact is you're going to have the military do the civilian aid work. In the most recent Department of Defense report on Afghanistan, there are over 1,000 U.S. military involved in the provincial reconstruction teams. If you look at the data in that report, and it does go back to June, there were 25 qualified civilians.
Well, serious challenges moving forward. I guess the question is, will there be a discussion of Afghanistan in the debate tonight between Barack Obama and John McCain? Dr. Anthony Cordesman, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Anthony Cordesman, of course, from the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
It certainly begs the question of if the military has got to do the civilian aid work, how are they going to do their day job, too?
Well, there's a lot of jobs to be done in Afghanistan, that's for sure. We're always on at the takeaway, I believe.
Yes, we are. And Election Day is exactly 4 weeks away, and we've got you covered. You can check out our complete coverage of the election on our website at vote2008.thetakeaway.org.
And you wanted to get in on our discussion with Anthony Cordesman about Afghanistan.
Regarding Afghanistan, I'm reminded of two quotes. The first by Nikita Khrushchev: America's support can be likened to the support a rope lends to a hanged man. The second quote is from The Man with No Name: when you hang a man, you better make sure he's dead.
Wisdom from our audience at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Here's today's takeaway.
Never underestimate the power of a party running for re-election.
Yes, with Todd Zwillick from Capital News Connection talking Congress is so inflamed about Lehman Brothers.
If you missed any of our Wall Street rescue coverage, you can catch us on iTunes. There's a link on our homepage, thetakeaway.org. We're also live blogging the presidential debate tonight at 9 p.m. That's round two between Barack Obama and John McCain. I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
Forget economists. One of the best arguments I've ever heard for market regulations comes from a fifth grader in Pennsylvania.
I have 2 guinea pigs, and when I give them, like, carrots, usually one takes all of it and the other one doesn't get any, so I have to put one somewhere else and break the carrot in half and give it to the other one, because it wouldn't be fair.
Molly Good, a fifth grader in Boiling Springs, Pennsylvania, knows a thing or two about fairness and wants to say a thing or two about the fairness of the federal bailout, keeping the big guinea pig from taking all the carrots. Carrots and sticks and, of course, pigs. Our financial coverage continues. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, October 7th, and that's such a vivid image. Yes. The big guinea pig eating all the carrots.
Molly Good should have her own show. Good morning, Adora.
Today we're going to talk to some real experts in fairness, fifth graders, and the evolution of revenge. And we're going to look at the complicated case of the Uyghurs at Guantanamo Bay. Also, a report on the global economic worries and a preview of tonight's presidential debate. And huge, huge voter registration numbers in Georgia. First, these headlines, though.
The markets are shaky but flat this morning. The Dow Jones Industrial Average expected to open slightly lower, if not flat. President Bush is urging patience as the Fed gets down to the work of buying up all the bad debt that's at the heart of the current credit crisis.
We don't want to rush into this situation and not have the program be effective.
Now that the White House's financial plan has passed, Congress is investigating how things got so bad. Lehman Brothers CEO Richard Fuld was up yesterday. He says what happened at Lehman Brothers could have happened to any investment bank, and he still doesn't understand why the Fed didn't help out.
Until the day they put me in the ground,
exactly.
I will wonder.
Today, three AIG executives will testify, and a House panel will take a closer look at how the crisis is hitting individual investors' retirement accounts.
Perhaps another extraordinary step for the Federal Reserve is working with the Treasury Department on a plan to buy commercial paper, short-term day-to-day business financing. The market for the paper, which relies on investors rather than banks, has virtually dried up.
Two Japanese citizens and a Japanese-born American will share the 2008 Nobel Prize in Physics for discoveries in the world of subatomic physics. The Academy says their work has provided a deeper understanding of what happens far inside the tiniest building blocks of matter.
It's all about quarks. You're full of quarks, Adora. We all are. In baseball, larger balls. The Red Sox beat Los Angeles 3-2 last night. That means they'll advance to face Tampa Bay on Friday. The Rays trounced the White Sox 6-2 last night to win their first ever playoff series. 4 weeks to the election, there's a debate tonight, and we want to know what you think.
I'm a retiree, and I would like to ask the candidates what they plan to do to preserve and protect both Social Security, not just for me and my generation, but for future generations of Americans.
What would your question be if you could ask one of the 15 questions that will be presented to the presidential candidates? What would you ask? Social Security, the economy, immigration? Give us your thought at 877-8-MY-TAKE or drop us a note at mytakeatthetakeaway.org.
Join the town meeting. That's The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
So, less than a half hour until Wall Street opens. The markets around the world are looking to Wall Street for confidence. Are they going to find it? Probably not. Dow futures, after about 2 or 3 hours this morning of being in positive territory, have switched south. Is there going to be a bounce back or a lower opening, and will it continue as volatile as it was yesterday? The Dow Jones Industrial Average was down more than 800 points at one point yesterday. There may be a positive opening on Wall Street markets, but what does it all mean? Confidence has been very hard to find in the wake of the bailout package that Congress passed last week. This week, the World Bank and finance ministers of the G7 countries have their annual meeting, but there doesn't seem to be much optimism that any of those institutions can get control of this financial meltdown. And indeed, the insecurity may be centered in Europe at this point. Mark Landler, the international economic correspondent of The New York Times, joins us from Washington. Mark, thanks for being with us.
Sure. Good morning.
My first question to you is, this seems to be evolving into a real test of the European Union, whether they can enforce currency and, policies that will have an overall effect on the European economy versus just sort of splitting into various countries when things get tough.
Well, this is a week that has shown the limitations of the European Union in very stark terms. The union does have an effective central bank like the Fed, the European Central Bank, and it has worked with the Fed to inject money into the system. It may also at some point begin lowering interest rates. But what the European Union doesn't have is any single fiscal authority or any single legislature that would allow it to put together something similar to the bailout package that the Bush administration put together in the last 2 weeks. And when you don't have that, you end up devolving into what has turned into a sort of a squabble over who is responsible for doing what, and an unwillingness to do bank rescues that may end up helping their neighbors. So what Europe has done, in effect, is a piecemeal approach to what is clearly a continent-wide problem, and that's why the situation in Europe looks so chaotic and has looked so chaotic for the last 4 or 5 days.
Meanwhile, European rules have kind of encouraged a sense of panic. The Irish declare that they're going to insure deposits, and all of a sudden, Europeans in Greece can deposit all their money in Irish banks and come under this umbrella, but there's no way that can work out. It seems as though the lack of uniformity from country to country is also a problem.
It is. And this issue of guaranteeing private bank deposits has become particularly troublesome in the last few days because, as you point out, there's a fear of money skipping across borders in search of safer havens. And all of this prompts people to say that in the end, the Europeans will find a common solution. They have to. They have to think a bit more creatively. They have to break through a few of these mental log jams. But, no economy can sustain more than a few days of this level of panic, and there is a belief that the Europeans will be able at some point to break through this impasse and develop solutions that, if not exactly like the one the Bush administration pursued, then perhaps something along the lines of assembling large pools of capital that they can use to target banks that are in big trouble. It hasn't happened yet, but people are sort of watching and waiting for that moment to arrive.
And meanwhile, Russia, Brazil, Indonesia, countries in Eastern and Central Europe, other emerging markets have to wait, and they take the brunt of this credit freeze in virtually all of their economic growth. What's the trouble spot to watch in those markets?
Well, there's a variety of places that you have to be concerned, because even before the crisis began, there were some countries that were running large trade deficits, that were very vulnerable to a loss of foreign capital. Their banks were heavily leveraged with foreign capital and foreign investment. I mean, among the places that are an immediate concern are even little countries. Iceland, which for years has had one of the largest and most aggressive banking sectors for a small country, banks that lent very heavily to foreigners, they're suffering probably the most serious national financial crisis of any country. And yesterday, their government assumed emergency power to basically intervene in any way that it deems necessary in the banking industry. I think there's reports this morning that they've taken over the nation's second largest bank. So it's happening now at the level of Iceland. The question is whether it were to begin to happen at such a scale with a country like Russia, which is also extremely vulnerable to capital flows. They've had major financial crises before. They're also vulnerable to a drop in the price of oil, and the fear of a global recession has driven oil prices down at a huge rate in the past few days. So you see these problems coming up in countries that would be, of course, a much bigger threat to the global stability than a country like Iceland.
Sure, and oil has dropped off 40% in value from its highs. Last question. I mean, this is really out of the scale of institutions like the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, right?
Absolutely. I mean, these were institutions that that did take a big role in previous financial crises, but they seem completely short of the task this time. And although you're going to have 100 or so central bank chiefs and finance ministers in Washington this week, and they are going to be meeting at these institutions, I think there's just going to be a general frustration that we don't have an institution in the world today, really short of the United States government, that has the resources and the authority and the flexibility to inject confidence back into the system. And what we've seen in the past 3 days, sadly, is that even the United States government seems to lack that capacity.
You know, the world is looking for a J.P. Morgan to write a check for all of its troubles. Mark Landler is the international economic correspondent of the New York Times. He joined us from Washington. Thanks, Mark.
Thank you very much, John.
Adora.
While economists and politicians try to tackle the economic woe, Senator Barack Obama and Senator John McCain will be debating in their second scheduled presidential debate, this time in Nashville, Tennessee. We go there now to Colby Sledge, who is a fifth-generation Tennessean and is covering the election. Good morning, Colby.
Good morning.
Do you want to set the scene for us? It's at the Belmont University, and what kind of audience are we expecting?
Well, we'll see a pretty diverse audience. As far as the town hall is concerned, you'll see probably about 80 to 100 Middle Tennesseans asking questions of the candidates, and then we'll also see several hundred people in the general audience, including several hundred students.
And what kind of issues are likely to come up that are just specific to Nashville and to Tennessee?
Well, I think obviously the economy will probably be the main issue. As it pertains to Nashville, we have some car or some auto plants here that have recently had layoffs. The state has also had a buyout recently. But we'll also probably see questions on health care and immigration. Immigration has been a particularly hot issue here in Nashville with a referendum tried to get on the ballot, making English the official or the only language for the metro government here. So I would expect to see some questions on immigration as well.
And weren't there some recent immigration raids? You want to tell us about those?
Yeah, sure. Within the last year, there have been several, raids, you would say, in counties surrounding Davidson County, where Nashville is located. There was one in December of 07 in a town called Springfield, where about 800 people either walked off the job or were taken off the job in a plant, and then there were also about 50 folks taken in raids in another county, in Murray County. So these are raids where local officials work with federal officials to kind of identify people who they believe may be in the country illegally, and then they go through the deportation process.
So immigration is an issue that is really on the minds of folks there. Not to mention, you also have a very large Kurdish population, so the Iraq war of great interest there.
Oh, absolutely. Nashville has, I believe, the largest Kurdish population in the United States. When the Iraqi elections were held, Nashville was one of the locations where Iraqis could file ballots. So I would expect and hope that there would be some representation in the town hall audience of the Kurdish population. And we are also very close to a large military base in Fort Campbell, and so I would expect there to be some sort of military veteran or families of military veterans asking what the situation will be in Iraq when one of these candidates becomes president.
Well, Colby, I think you started off this interview accurately. We're talking about a very diverse audience to be expected there at Belmont University this evening for the presidential debate. Thanks for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Colby Sledge is a higher education reporter for the Tennessean newspaper. If you could be at the debate tonight, what would you ask?
My question to McCain and Obama is, how is he going to improve schools when they both support open borders?
Thank you very much. We'd like to hear your questions. If you could be there, what would you ask? 877-8-MY-TAKE.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. It's a twisted tragedy worthy of Kafka, and it's also a legal dilemma worthy of the Harvard Law Review. But today, a federal judge in Washington, D.C. will hear the case of 17 Chinese Uyghurs who've been held at Guantanamo Bay for 7 years. The men, part of an ethnic minority in China, have been cleared for release since 2004, but the government has declined to let them go, saying they could be tortured if they returned to China. No other country has agreed to take them. George Clark joins us now. He's a lawyer with Miller and Chevalier, who represents two of the 17 Chinese Uyghurs. He will attend the 10 a.m. hearing in federal court in D.C. this morning to determine if the Uyghurs should be paroled, possibly, to the United States. Mr. Clark, thanks for being with us.
Absolutely. No problem. Thanks for having me.
There are two parts to this case, as I see it. I mean, from your perspective, there's probably 30. But first of all, the circumstances as to why the 17 Chinese Uyghurs came to be held at Guantanamo. Could you remind us?
Well, they were picked up in Pakistan by bounty hunters, essentially, sold by the Pakistanians to the Afghanis, I believe, first, and then found their way into the hands of the Americans, who then brought them to Cuba.
And then eventually, in the course of the tortured due process at Guantanamo, it was determined that they were not being held on a legitimate charge, and the courts decided that there was no reason to hold them. What happened then?
Well, I think that part sort of bears a little bit of focus, too. I mean, that's only happened very recently, that the government finally conceded, after knowing that they were not enemy combatants for years, only finally conceded under court order on September 30th, so just about a week ago, that they were not enemy combatants. At that point, they were moved to a different camp within Guantanamo that is isolated from anyone who is still classified as an enemy combatant and given a modest amount of greater privileges. And so that's where they sit right now. And our hearing today at 10 is to determine, so what's next? You can't find a place for them to go. They obviously can't go back to China. So there's only really one option left, and that option is to bring them to the States.
Now, there are two issues here. One is humanitarian, and you can elaborate on that if you like. But the other one is that apparently the Bush administration is contending that the judiciary has no authority to force the U.S. government, to force the executive, to take these people into U.S. custody. This is a test of the separation of powers here. Is that how you're seeing it?
I think it absolutely is, although we certainly disagree with that position. I mean, it's a multifaceted argument. First off, there really hasn't even been an immigration determination that these people can't come to the U.S. But setting that aside, we're not asking for an immigration determination. This is a habeas judge. It's a judge that's sitting on a petition for habeas corpus, and habeas corpus is about releasing the body. So if the United States can still hold them in Guantanamo, how is that releasing the body? And that federal district judge has all the power to release the body. And the only place that the government is saying he can be released is the United States, because obviously a federal district judge in the United States can't order a foreign country to take somebody.
What do your defendants want? What do your clients want?
They just want to get out of Guantanamo and not go to China, basically. That's really what they care about. You know, they love America. They've loved America for a long, long time. The big Radio Free Asia listeners, and certainly have no qualms with America. And so I think they'd be quite happy to be in America, but they'd also be happy to be in a European country. They'd be happy to be in Canada. You know, they're not particular.
To what extent can you argue in court, or will the judge allow you to argue in court, that these individuals were taken possibly as a favor to the Chinese government, and that some sort of geopolitical issue has gotten in the way of these people's freedom?
Well, I think we already have argued that to some extent. I don't know how effective it's been. I will say I think the court understands that aspect. Based on statements that Judge Urbina has made, it seems pretty clear that he understands that there's something much bigger than just the 17 individuals at stake here.
You know, finally, I mean, I know that these people were detained in Afghanistan, and the circumstances are unclear enough for the courts to rule that there's no reason for them to be held as enemy combatants. But is there anything you can tell me about their background, about their activities in China? What kind of people are they?
Well, I know the two that I represent better than everybody, okay? Obviously, the other 15 I haven't personally met. I mean, I've talked to their lawyers about their facts, but my two I've met probably 8 times. And, they are gentle, normal men. They are not in any sense extremists. They don't have an extremist ideology. They are people who essentially got wrapped up in something much bigger than themselves and find themselves, you know, a long ways away from home and a long ways away and not able to go back home. And stuck in a U.S. military facility.
You want to handicap your chances today in court? I mean, what's likely to happen, best case, worst case scenario?
Well, best case scenario is we won't even be able to speak. Sabin Willett, who's leading the argument, will not even be able to speak, and the judge will have essentially determined that enough is enough and the time is for him to rule. Now, that ruling, I'm sure, will be appealed. There'll be a question about whether we can prevent the government from staying the effect of the order during that appeal. But that would be the best case scenario. The worst case scenario would be that he would determine that he can't order them released to the U.S., in which case we will appeal. So I think those are the two options. I suppose the third option is he gives the government more time. But I think at some point we've had enough time, and I think that's right now.
George Clark, lawyer with Miller and Chevalier, who represents two of the 17 Chinese Uyghurs in Guantanamo. He will attend the 10 a.m. hearing in D.C. this morning to determine if Uyghurs should be paroled. Uyghur music on The Takeaway. And now headlines from Richard Haig.
And John, 28 minutes past the hour right now. The Federal Reserve is creating a plan to buy short-term funds called commercial paper. That's what businesses use to fund their day-to-day operations. Prices on commercial paper soared yesterday as the interest rate banks charge each other went up. Australia's central bank lifted Asian markets today by cutting rates by 1%. It was the largest rate cut since 1992. And Wall Street is headed for a slightly higher open today amid hopes that the central banks around the world will follow suit. The opening bell will ring in just a minute or two. European stock markets remain volatile. Shares in the Royal Bank of Scotland have lost nearly 40% of their value, hitting their lowest level in 15 years. A top general says Russian forces will begin their withdrawal from that buffer zone in Georgia tomorrow. The country must be out of the territory by Friday, according to agreements it reached after its brief war in Georgia this summer. Defense Secretary Robert Gates endorsed efforts to reach out to members of the Taliban in Afghanistan who may be considered reconcilable. He also rejected assertions made by the top British commander there that the war is not winnable. And the Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences has announced that two Japanese citizens and an American will share the 2008 Nobel Prize in Physics. Their research involves the discovery of a mechanism called spontaneous broken symmetry in subatomic physics.
It's really important.
You have one. You told us earlier.
I don't have symmetry. I have
quarks
in me.
Quarks.
You have quarks, and you're full of quarks.
Lots of
Richard.
Quarks.
Yes. Thank you.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering auto insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, this is Becky. I live in Pennsylvania. If I could ask the candidates a question, it would be tell us what's in your tax returns. Number two, what's their specific three-point plan for the economy? And number three, what are they going to do to help the rest of us who've had our houses for a long time and are still strapped?
what three-point plan, or how many points would you want in the plan if you were a part of tonight's town hall debate? What questions do you have about the candidates? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytakeatthetakeaway.org. Markets are open, by the way. The S&P 500 is up a little less than 1%.
Speaking of the presidential candidates and their debate tonight, in Georgia, voters have been casting ballots since September 22nd. Now, that's interesting, but what's even more interesting are some numbers released by Georgia's Secretary of State yesterday, numbers that include a 27% increase in black voter registration and not a similar rise among white voters. For more on this, we're going straight to Atlanta to William Boone, a professor of political science at Clark Atlanta University. Welcome back, Professor Boone.
Yeah, thanks for the invitation.
So, tell us about these numbers released by the Secretary of State. A real big boom in voter registration in African American community.
Yes, that's correct. Black citizens have been registering in record numbers here in the state. You can trace it all the way back to the primaries, the Democratic primaries in particular. And those numbers actually, when we started out in Georgia, about 600,000 folk who were eligible to register and not registered. That number is almost cut in half now, to about 300,000. And that's particularly evident in the black community, as you indicated. In the white community, the numbers just aren't that high.
Well, when you look at the actual raw numbers, it's almost even when you consider that there are far more whites in Georgia than African Americans, but you have 176,000 white voters, new voters added to the rolls there, and 164,000 white voters. How does that change the dynamic of the way that Barack Obama and John McCain campaign there? I mean, McCain is certainly way ahead in the polls, but do you think there's an added calculation to be made there for the Obama camp?
I think so. I think what's happening here, what the Obama camp is probably dependent upon and what others are looking at is whether or not the black turnout exceeds its normal turnout. In every county almost every county that we've looked at, it seems that they expect an increase in voter turnout. So if black turnout, let's say about 95% of turnout could help Obama a great deal. Certainly has a couple of that with the fact that Obama will have to get a significant number of white votes, especially younger white voters, 18 to 29, pick up some of the Latino vote as well. But it does put him in position of having a good shot at Georgia.
And what's interesting also is that the Secretary of State released numbers reflecting those who have already voted, saying that nearly 40% of the early ballots were from African Americans. Yeah. Do you ever recall that happening? Because usually, no. Isn't it the other way around? African Americans wait until voting day.
No, in our recollection, that has never happened before since early voting has been around. And it's because black folk had generally even taken advantage of absentee voting when that was the norm. No, this is a different phenomenon. This is something different happening here. And the lines at the advanced voting facilities are very long. Folk are waiting in line as much as an hour or more, even at advanced voting.
Wow. How do you think the polls are missing some of these really interesting trends there, Ron?
Well, I think that's very easy because generally, as you know, polls that are taken are not taken necessarily of people who have never voted before. Usually in the African-American community, the number of African-Americans included in those polls is usually kind of a rough guess. Then we're talking about folk who have telephones who answered polling questions via the land phones, and that, too, is a problem. I think all of those are the kind of problems that we know are happening here in Georgia, and we're talking about young folk as well. So, and if we go to those polls, we've been to a couple of these advanced voting sites, and what you see are an interesting kind of phenomenon. You see a good number of elderly black folk, and you also see a good number of younger black folk as well. I mean, the other day we were looking, we saw young black mothers wheeling their children and baby carriages up there. And we also saw older black folk. In fact, we ran into one older black woman who indicated she looked to be about 70 years old, I would guess. And she indicated that this was her first time registering. In fact, yesterday was the last day they could register. And this is her first time registering, which I found rather interesting.
And, Professor, is there some great irony in the fact that the Obama campaign actually stopped running ads in Georgia and has pulled out some of their ground forces, thinking perhaps that John McCain was just too far ahead in the polls.
Yeah, that is a bit ironic. Although there are still some Obama forces here, you're quite right. He did pull back on some of them, and that is interesting because at the same time that that Obama pulled out, we now find that the Republican and Democratic candidates in the U.S. Senate race, Saxby Chambliss and Jim Martin. Jim Martin now is closing the gap on the Republican Saxby Chambliss. And there are a lot of things that are happening in Georgia, I think, that sometimes we're missing as well. The economy, of course, in the country at large is deteriorating, but especially so in the state of Georgia. You have a good number of companies pulling out of Georgia. As of August, the unemployment rate had reached 6%. Wow. So all these things seem to be coming together at this time, and it may well cause some of the folk who were going to stay home to come out and vote one way or the other.
William Boone, thank you so much for that snapshot of Georgia right now, the politics in Georgia. William Boone is a professor of political science at Clark Atlanta University. Now, headline from Richard Hake, who's sitting in for Femi Okeh this week. Richard.
Adora, 21 minutes before the top of the hour. Despite the pummeling price of oil, the cost of heating your home will be much more expensive this winter. Households that use oil as fuel will see a price increase of 23%, according to the Energy Department. Natural gas and electric heating is a bit cheaper, with prices up about 10%. Defense Secretary Robert Gates just arrived in the newly independent country of Kosovo. He says the U.S. will continue its troop presence there until late next year. The visit coincides with an expected legal battle as Serbia disputes Kosovo's legality as a separate nation. Forecasters say Tropical Storm Marco could hit Mexico with near hurricane strength later today. The National Hurricane Center says it's a very small storm with winds extending only 10 miles from the center. However, workers on some oil platforms had to be evacuated. The American author of a best-selling controversial book, Blasting Barack Obama, was detained Tuesday by security officials in Kenya, and now they're deporting him because he didn't have a work visa. Jerome Corsi is the author of The Obama Nation, Leftist Politics and the Cult of Personality. Obama is widely popular in Kenya since his father was an economist there. And Somali pirates are willing to now lower the ransom for a hijacked Ukrainian cargo ship from $20 million to $8 million. The vessel carries a cargo of 33 tanks, but is surrounded by six U.S. warships. Pirates took possession of the boat late last month. Those are your headlines.
Thanks, Richard.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. Markets are open on Wall Street, and there is a reaction to one story we've been reporting all morning. The U.S. Federal Reserve has announced a step to join the commercial paper market. That means that the federal government will be lending money to businesses. Normally, that's taken care of on an investor-to-investor basis, but the federal government will be lending money to businesses to fund their operations. Joining us now is Vikas Bajaj, who's the New York Times correspondent. Vikas, how do we know that this is having an impact? Certainly the markets seem to think that this is a positive impact.
Yeah, John, I would suggest that don't look at the stock market for the impact of this, because the impact we will see will be in the commercial paper market and the credit markets, broadly speaking. We see interest rates go down across the board for corporations and banks to borrow money. I think that will be sort of the proof that this is working.
So is there any indication this morning? I mean, as we've tried to investigate what's going on in the commercial paper market, it sort of varies sector to sector. Some businesses are fine, others are having real trouble.
Sure.
And, you know, the interest rate spreads don't necessarily indicate what's going on generally.
Yeah, it is kind of a fragmented market. So today, you know, the overnight commercial paper interest rate, so the money that the rate that somebody would pay to borrow money for one day, fell to 2.9% from 3.7%. That's a pretty good sign that something has happened. But at the same time, you know, the longer maturity commercial paper, so you know, longer borrowings for 3 months or 1 month, those are still higher today. So, you know, it's kind of a mixed picture. I don't think one could say that this has unclogged anything yet.
So loosening on really short-term money, it seems that there's still high yields on the long-term money. What about Treasury bill rates? Certainly the lower yield on those rates was an indication that companies were just climbing over themselves to put money into T-bills and were willing to get almost nothing in return for it.
Yeah, no, we've seen some backup in yields in 3 month paper, in 3 month T-bills and 1 month T-bills. They're still very low, John. It's, you know, the 4 week I'm looking at it now, it's 0.46%. So it's basically a 0.5% return on your money. It's not a very, very good return. It's a lot higher than yesterday, but not great.
But those are really the indicators, the yield on Treasury bills, which indicates how relaxed people are about getting into federal notes, and the yield coming down on commercial paper, which indicates, the price of money is actually coming down.
Yeah, those are good indicators. You should also look at LIBOR, which tells you, at least gives you a sense of banks' borrowing costs, which have been pretty high as well.
Now, I'm not an expert on this, but the LIBOR seems not to have moved much at all, and that's sort of the upper-level interest rate on sort of bank-to-bank loans, right?
Actually, LIBOR has been moving up in the last few days. I mean, it jumped quite significantly in the last couple of weeks, and it had fallen back a little bit, and then it jumped again. And same situation with LIBOR, where you have differences on a day-to-day basis between, you know, the overnight rate versus the rates for longer-term loans. Depending on what's really the biggest concern at banks, they're more willing to lend overnight or not.
Well, because you know it all, but we're all just learning how to monitor these commercial paper markets. Thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Vikash Bajaj is New York Times correspondent. He spoke with us from New York, monitoring the commercial paper market as the Fed agrees to get involved in that debt market.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, October 7th, and time for some headlines from Richard Hake, who's sitting in for Femi Okeh. Richard?
And Adora, it's 12 minutes before the top of the hour. We're just getting word now that Iranian news reports say Iran forced a Western aircraft that accidentally entered its airspace to land, then allowed the plane to continue after questioning its passengers. One official news agency says the plane was American, but the state-owned television quotes an unidentified senior Iranian official as saying it belonged to a European aid agency. Neither report says when this happened. The U.S. Air Force says they have no information that any such incident had occurred. They're checking the report. The Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesperson says they have no information on this case. In presidential candidates will face off tonight in their second of three debates in the town hall style at Belmont University in Nashville. Yesterday, the campaigns continued to spar over the economy and accusations of shady associations. In Asheville, where he was preparing for tonight's debate, Barack Obama said John McCain cannot turn the page on the economy.
The American people are losing right now. They're losing their jobs. They're losing their health care. They're losing their homes. They're losing their savings.
Tonight's debate will be a mix of domestic and international issues. Those are some of your top stories this morning.
Thanks, Richard.
Thank you, Richard.
You're welcome.
Here's a question. Is it fair to grow up and have to deal with this financial crisis as an adult?
What happens now could change our life in 20 years. Like, when we're older and adults and stuff, this could still be going, because maybe someone makes a bad move and all this other bad stuff happens. And then it causes all this money to be made, and then we're going to have to be paying really high taxes whenever we grow up and all that stuff.
That's Max Leo thinking about the future in Mrs. Janet Kunkel's fifth grade class at Iron Forge Educational Center in Boiling Springs, Pennsylvania. Yesterday, we visited that classroom and asked them about the fairness of all kinds of things going on in the world, but particularly the financial bailout that's been passed in Washington and is trying to reassure markets. Here's what Matthew Pennybaker had to say about it.
Like, if someone threw a punch and the hurt person gets in trouble, I think the person that threw the punch should get in more trouble because he's causing the problem.
Well, how many times have you heard the phrase, life's not fair? I have two sets of twins, and believe me, fairness between the two sets of twins is a big issue in our house. We think intuitively about fairness, but on the big questions, are we actually good at determining what is fair, and do we have to decide between fairness and our need to revenge or find blame in all kinds of issues? That's certainly something Congress has been dealing with. Joining us now is Benedict Carey, who's a New York Times science reporter. He joins us from Portland, Oregon. Benedict, thanks for being with us.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
You know, it's a challenge to sort out fairness from all the other emotional impulses that we might have in a situation like a financial bailout where we didn't cause the problem, but yet we're called upon to help fix it. How challenging is it?
Well, very much so in this case, because this is extremely complicated. No one's sure exactly who's to blame. But I think you can see that, certainly constituents and members of Congress were extremely sensitive to this issue of fairness, which held up the passage of this bailout. And I think, you know, they were criticized for being childish or stupid, but the delay really comes out of what are very strong instincts to want to sort of police the society, the world that you're living in, and make sure people, you know, follow the rules.
And I think if the situation is abstract, it's harder to decide what's fair and what isn't. Whereas if people are close to you, if your emotional connection to what's going on is actually very close, sometimes it's easier. Here's what Molly Good, one of the fifth graders in Pennsylvania, had to say about how she deals with fairness in her own life.
Do you get angry when you see people that are being treated unfairly?
Like, if it's my friends and people I care about, like, I'll get really mad and nasty at the person who's being unfair.
So is anger and feeling nasty constructive in an evolutionary biological perspective?
Well, yes. I mean, it's very much so. It's a self-protective thing, of course. You want to essentially let people know that you won't be taken advantage of, or your friends or your family members won't be, to have extract some cost for being exploited. The question is a little different when you're talking about, you know, someone who's not in your family, who's not in Molly's family. Maybe if she saw another kid being picked on in the playground, she'd feel that that's unfair, that's wrong. The question is, would she then act and intervene or say something? And that's a different kind of sense of fairness related to the first one. But it's what scientists call third-party punishment or third-party fairness. You know, you're acting in effect, or you're deciding to act as a good Samaritan or as a citizen enforcer to try to put things right. And that's a little bit more analogous to the bailout situation.
Well, it was amazing in talking to the fifth graders yesterday how much they are able and are interested in talking about money. Listen to Laurel Gramsley.
I think, like, if he doesn't give you the money, I think the parents should, like, take away that person's, like, most prized possession, and they have to work for the money and until they can give it back. The money back to the parent, I think they should keep that item, and then when he finally pays it back, they can give it.
I mean, you can almost hear Congressman Waxman at the congressional hearings yesterday with Richard Fuld in the Laurel sentiments there. There's an intuitive quality to precisely what she's saying, right, Benedict?
There is. It shows itself very early in kids, and it translates also quickly to money. Things that are valuable, and that's the way that this stuff is studied. you know, they run all sorts of investment games to see how long it takes for people to get angry at each other or to punish each other or to burn each other, how often they cooperate, and so on. But you can see from Laurel's comments there that she understands viscerally exactly that, you know, if someone takes something from you unfairly, that that you should make them feel that loss themselves in a way that's precisely or very much matched to the, you know, the initial infraction. It's called what psychologists call just desserts punishment, which is just a phrase meaning we sort of calculate the punishments we would inflict very carefully depending on what the infraction was.
Well, Hammurabi called it eye for an eye, I think. Where do we learn fairness? Here's a theory from Madison Hemler, who's a fifth grader in Pennsylvania.
I kind of learned it from my parents because my dad would always buy my mom a candy bar and then she'd always split it with me.
It sounds innocent, but there's something very profound about that example.
Yeah, I think there's no question that parents, by their example, maybe most of all, are transmitting, communicating these ideas of fairness. Evolutionary scientists have reasons to believe that those same properties are stabilizing things in communities, especially small groups. Seeing this play out, among the adults that are closest to you is a strong message.
Benedict, how does that work in bigger groups? How does our notion of wanting to hold somebody accountable, does that make us better off as a group? Does it beg the question of meting out that just dessert? And is that process, does that make us a better community?
Well, that's an open question. Punishment is costly for the person doing the punishing, and for $700 billion this is a bailout, I guess. But it's costly for the person doing the punishing and the person on the other end, and it can get retributive. It can get carried away. It's not clear that the same sense of fairness is equally applicable to large, sort of diverse things like complicated things like the U.S. economy as it is on the playground or in a family or in a small village or town.
Thanks to Benedict Carey, science reporter for The New York Times and author of today's Science Times article, Wired for Justice. Also, thanks to Mrs. Kunkel's class in Boiling Springs, Pennsylvania.
And you can check out a video of the students from Mrs. Kunkel's fifth grade class on our website. There's the link, thetakeaway.org.
We're always on at The Takeaway. Election Day, 4 weeks away. We've got you covered. Tonight, of course, is the second presidential debate.
I would ask about the environmental policies of the two candidates because now, of course, the economy has taken center stage, but what happens to the environment will definitely inform what happens to the economy.
You don't have to go to Nashville to be a part of the town meeting. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
And tonight we'll have our own sort of town hall. We'll be live blogging on the debate along with you on our website, thetakeaway.org. Join us at 9 p.m. Eastern Time.
If you missed any of our Wall Street rescue coverage, you can catch up with us on iTunes. There's a link on our homepage at thetakeaway.org. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Adora Udoji, and this is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.